Donald Jeffries Show.
And welcome to the Donald Jeffries Show. It's Donald Jeffries here with you. My special guest today is somebody I've been wanting to talk to for years. Author Brian Toohey has been recognized by the U.S. Supreme Court as a scholarly authority on the game fixing in sports. He's the author of many books, and the one we're going to be talking about most of is The Fix Is In, The Showbiz Manipulations of the NFL, MLB, NBA, NHL, and NASCAR. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Don. I appreciate it.
Oh, I've been wanting to for so long. I got to tell you a little bit about my history. You beat me to the punch with The Fix Is In because, you know, I've had six books published, but I, as a young guy in the late 70s, I started, you know, promulgating the theory that the NFL, especially all sports were fixed, but especially the NFL. And everybody that knew me, you know, heard that all the time. And eventually, you know, got a lot of recruits that, yeah, it's true. It does look like it's fixed. So congratulations, but I never put a book together about it. So you beat me to the punch. And so we got to talk about it. So what were you a big sports fan? Were you like me? You watched games and you said, wow, this is fixed. I have to write something about it. How did you get started on that?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up a big sports fan, and I had two older brothers who were sports fans as well. So it was ingrained in the whole family. And really, I think I got the bug initially because my next oldest brother, he's 9 years older than me. He would gamble on games, and he would always be saying, you know, man, that was a funky ending. Something seems weird there. Maybe that was fixed. Maybe that was fixed. Look how this benefited the league and et cetera, et cetera. And so that kind of got the bug in me. And then I read a couple of books, one called They Call It a Game by former NFL player Bernie Parrish.
Yes, yes, yes. I read that.
And then another one called Interference by Dan Moldea. And he talked about organized crime and fixing games for gambling purposes. And I kind of put all that together, did the research, and out came The Fix Is In.
Great. Well, I remember Bernie Parrish. He just kind of injects it into, I think it's a sentence or two. It just says, I personally participated in many fixed games. And he doesn't really elaborate on it. But I remember reading that book. It's like, wow, that's an explosive allegation.
Well, yeah. And the one that blew my mind in the book, too, is he talked a lot about Super Bowl III and how with the merger and how much was at stake.
Yes.
And he basically said in the book, too, he didn't come out and say that game was specifically fixed. But he alluded to it and said, geez, it's amazing how that outcome benefited the owners to the tune of billions of dollars, and had it gone the other way, that money likely wouldn't have been as lucrative as it was. And Absolutely. So, yeah, it's just, there's a lot of questions you can raise about a lot of different games, but it all comes down to the fact that all of these leagues are big multi-billion dollar businesses.
Well, absolutely. And that was the first game that, at the time, I was too little. In fact, I rooted for the Jets because I loved underdogs and I hated the Colts. But so I was excited that they won. But it was later, in retrospect, that I started looking at it. And some people in, you know, hidden corners of the world were, you know, talking about Jimmy Orr waving his hands. He's wide open on that flea flicker play. And why did Earl Morrill just hold the ball and throw an interception? And then a couple years later was Earl Morrill and Don Shula, who was the coach of the Colts, were they both rewarded because they had the undefeated season with the Miami Dolphins?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, did you – and, of course, years later, you had Bubba Smith, before he died, suddenly came out near the end of his life, suspiciously near the end of his life, when he was a Miller Lite beer commercial star, and just started talking about all the Colts knew it was fixed. How did we get in the 28 times of that game? Any points? Did you go into all of that?
Yeah, I talk about that because, yeah, right, Bubba Smith did an interview in Playboy magazine where he thought the game was suspicious, which is interesting because, like you said, he played in it, and he played on the losing side. And he couldn't figure out what the heck happened. I mean, that Colts team was legitimately legendary.
Yes.
In terms of, I think they had the biggest point differential in their favor. They averaged a win by like 18 points a game, which was a record that stood until the Patriots beat it just a couple of years ago. And they only beat it by like a fraction of a point. But that team was legendary. And to think that they lost to the third seed AFC team. Yeah. that was legitimately kind of a junior league compared to the NFL,
right,
and led by, you know, Joe Namath, as great he is. If Joe Namath didn't win that Super Bowl III, I don't think anybody would know who Joe Namath is today.
It was
all that game. And that's another thing. I mean, you think about the celebrity that came out of that from his win and how that helped bolster the NFL, the money that came out of the merger and the TV deals that came out of that. I mean, there's just so much that indicates that, you know, that game had to go that way. And, you know, one of the things I argue about in the Fix This In, and I've talked to lawyers and FBI agents and other people, you know, it's not illegal if the NFL wanted to fix that game or any game. Right. There's no law that prevents them from fixing your own game because they're legitimately entertainment. And if they're entertainment, well, what does that mean? It just means that it's not a sport in the way many people think it's a sport. It's really entertainment, more like professional wrestling. We all know what professional wrestling is. So if the NFL and professional wrestling and the NBA and professional wrestling and the NHL and professional wrestling are all the same thing, well, what does that mean? That means that these games can be manipulated to get the best outcome that generates the most money in TV ratings for these leagues.
Yeah, and they make no bones about it. They don't tell you. It's not – there's no law against them fixing it. I mean, look at the WWF. I mean, they don't say that the matches are rigged. I mean, people – and some people actually believe it. But I mean, it's pretty obvious. But it's the same thing here. If they were caught, they would say, you know, hey, we said – we didn't say the games are rigged. But, I mean, anybody who watches these games, I mean, it's just – but going back to the Jets quickly – as a little kid, you know, followed the team formerly known as the Redskins back then. Yeah. I knew how bad one of the defensive backs was, who was the hero of one of the heroes of Super Bowl III, Johnny Sample, who was a horrible defensive back for the Redskins. The Redskins had a terrible defense, and he couldn't make their team. And for him to be, like, you know, one of the heroes, I remember even as a kid just kind of being, again, I was too naive, I guess, to understand it. But I'm sure you go into this in the book, but when I started talking about games being fixed, I said, you know, first of all, you really wouldn't need any players except maybe the quarterback, but because referees in the NFL and the NBA especially, they can determine the outcomes of these games on their own. They can call holding whenever they want. They admit they can call it on any play. They can call pass interference pretty much at every passing play, blocking in the back, all these kinds of things. And the fact that they call it, when they call it, how, you know, how crucial are those calls? Is a touchdown get called back? How many times does that team win that loses? I mean, did you go into any of that?
Oh, I talk about that, definitely. I don't get into specific statistics on it. But, yeah, like you said, I mean, I think we've all seen it if we've watched, like I said, the NFL and the NBA, how much officials really can alter the outcome of any game. And it's amazing, you know, it's one of those things where you have all these analytic people and they get so into, like, you know, how many of this happened, how many of that happened. But one thing you can't quantify is, like, non-calls or penalties that should have been called penalties that weren't called penalties because they're subjective calls. And I remember a few years ago I did track penalties on my website. And, like, the Packers that year went 15-1. They almost went undefeated. And I remember this pretty specifically. But in those 16 games, they had 11 games where they did not have an offensive holding call against them. Yeah. 11 games worth without a single offensive holding call. Yeah. Well, if your offensive line is allowed to get away with murder, you know, you're going to win more games than you lose. And especially when you have a quarterback like Aaron Rodgers, you give him just a few more extra seconds, get away with a holding call here or there, mm-hmm. and it's going to make him be a better player and make the team better and, again, win more games. And that's how you can manipulate these things. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, the penalty that kills the touchdown. It can just be the penalty that makes a team that was on a drive go from first and 10 to first and 20, and it just throws everything into a tailspin, and that kills the drive. Or, like I said, it could be non-calls, things that should be called penalties that are completely overlooked because, you know, the rule book is so subjective and open to interpretation. And, you know, again, a team can get away with murder, and if the penalties aren't going to fly, if, you know, as the commentators like to say, boy, they're really letting them play out there today, well, what happened to the rule book? Why aren't we following the rules today then?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I go back to that 69 season because I think that that 69 was interesting for a couple of reasons. That you had a miracle. You basically had a miracle team in every sport, that all three major sports. And they all three happened to be from New York. You had the miracle Jets. You had the miracle Mets, which is probably an even more improbable upset in the World Series of the against
true, yeah.
A Baltimore team as well. And then you had the Knicks that won in 69. So New York had, that was a very good year for them, but that I think
the last
was
good year for them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I mean, you know, you had 69, but before that, you know, 69 Super Bowl, when it kind of raised eyebrows, the only other time, you know, I'm sure there were gambling and stuff was involved, but you had the 1965 playoff game, and they called it a playoff game because I guess they tied. They had to have a game between the Packers and the Colts. for the Western Division Championship, I think, when they're and I don't know if you've seen that or not. If you've seen footage of the game-winning kick, I think in overtime, that the Packers won on, Don Chandler's field goal clearly is no good. I mean, it goes wide, and they watch it sometime when you can. And
yeah, no, that one I've never seen. I have to look that up.
You got to check it out, and because you can still see it, I think. But what's hilarious about it is when you look at highlight films of the 65 season or whatever, they kind of used to maybe allude to it a little bit, that there was some controversy, but they literally don't say anything now. So if you're watching it and you're paying any attention at all, you just watch this kick and you see it sail wide. And then you see the Packers celebrate. It's like, wait a minute, he missed the kick. And so it's very interesting to see. But I think you're younger than me. So were you old enough to be watching? Because I know in the 70s is when I really started noticing. I used to call these teams chosen teams. And there was very little drama in sports back then, because you knew basically the NFL, it was going to be the Steelers or the Raiders, maybe in the AFC. And it was going to be the Cowboys and maybe the Vikings to lose in the Super Bowl, whatever. They pretty much dominated that entire decade. And I don't know how many games I would watch and teams I liked back then, like the Patriots at that time, or teams that I, you know, had the Lions, or they had no chance of winning. And they would be beating one of these chosen teams. And then Roger Staubach or Bradshaw, somebody would make a miraculous comeback. And I saw it over and over again. And I kept saying to myself, but you never see like any of the teams that aren't any good. You never see them make a comeback and beat one of the chosen teams. Yeah. Did you observe that kind of stuff, or what really did you observe that was most suspicious to you?
Well, you're a little older than me. To say, so I grew up. I was a kid in the early 70s. I grew up more like in the later 80s,
right,
okay. And 90s. But you know, a lot of it for me, actually, one of the main things was actually Michael Jordan. Because yes. I lived outside Chicago, and that whole era of the Bulls and Michael Jordan, I mean, I got it that he was a great player. I mean, I understood that, and that Scottie Pippen was a good player and they had a good team. But when, you know, you started to learn that, like, legitimately 75% of people who identified as NBA fans identified as Chicago Bulls fans, and then the Bulls kept winning and winning no matter who they played, what they played. And, you know, they always seemed to get the calls go their way. You couldn't even, like, breathe on Michael Jordan the wrong way, or he drew a penalty. You know, that was the sort of thing that made me go, you know, this seems to be working out too well for too many people. And then he had the whole retirement thing, which I think was a complete sham. And then he came back, and it just, like, picked up right where they left off. And that was one of the things I know. I mean, we've been talking about the NFL, and there's stuff in the NFL too that made me kind of suspicious, but I think it was that whole Bulls thing, and how it wasn't the NBA, it was the Bulls, and it wasn't really the Bulls, it was Michael Jordan, and it seemed like everything was catered to that really started to make me think, before I even started getting into this researching and that sort of thing, that made me go, wait a second.
Yeah,
you know, how many times can this happen?
I remember watching some of the, I kind of lost interest in the the NBA by that point. But yeah, you're right, Jordan. And what I liked is, it's like they have these sayings, whether it's the NFL saying you could call holding on every play. So
yeah,
my response to that is, then why don't they?
Yeah. That's the thing. Like I said earlier, when you hear it all the time, even today, you know, with announcers saying, boy, they're really letting them play out there. Well, again, where's the rule book? I mean, if doing this and this is pass interference, then, like you said, why isn't it being called all the time? Because I see these guys doing it all the time. And I get it, okay, the speed of the game, blah, blah, blah. But still, if it's only called once in a game when it should have been called 25 times, like you said earlier, well, why did it get called that one time? Why that one specific time? Because it wasn't sending a message at that point. It was too late to send a message that we're going to be watching you. So why was it called? And the same thing with holding and other such subjective penalties. You know, I get false start, you have to call because it happens. But, you know, the subjective ones, and even things on the catch, you know, whether it was a catch or not a catch.
Oh, and they changed that. They changed
that rule all the time.
Yeah, which is ridiculous. It used to be, I mean, when I was playing football or anything, I mean, if the ball touched the ground, it wasn't a catch, period. Now exactly. It can touch it, and they have all these weird things. Did it do? Did you keep control, and did you make a football move? Nonsense. But I think it makes it easier for referees to control it. But just as you hear they can call holding every play in the NFL, you also hear in the NBA, and again, I haven't watched the NBA for a long time, but they used to say this stuff about, well, he's going to get that call. The Stars get that call. Why would the Stars get that call? I mean, it's either a foul or not, but it's, I don't know why people don't question that.
No, and I think that's the thing that's blatant and right in front of many fans' eyes that they're not willing to accept. And I think part of it comes down to the fact that, and I've had plenty of conversations with different people about this. It's like if you're an NBA fan and I talk to you about how, you know, they give LeBron or they used to give Kobe or Michael Jordan all the benefit of the doubts, like you say, they're going to get the call because they're the star player, you'd get pushback. But then if I talked about the NFL and said, okay, well, they're doing this to help this player or this team, that NBA fan may go, okay, you know, I can accept that. I just can't accept it in my sport or for my team. And I think that's what it is it starts getting personal for people. And when it starts getting personal, when it's something you grew up believing in, something you spend a lot of time, energy, effort, and money into following and being a fan of or whatever, and then someone comes along and says, hey, you know, the Tooth Fairy, Santa Claus, it's not real. That's when they start going, whoa, 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 whoa. You know, you can't be saying that about my sport. You can't be saying that about my team. And I think that's what it boils down to, is it's hard to accept it when it becomes personal like that.
Absolutely. Well, I think it was probably about 20 years ago or so, something around that, when Shaq was dominating. And they made the mistake of, or maybe they did it on purpose, to advertise these things. And they like to advertise their corruption, I think, politically and otherwise, just to, you know, to let you know we're doing this. You do something about it. But they wired up one of the refs for a playoff game that Shaquille O'Neal was involved in. And they caught him going over to the scorer's table and saying, how many fouls is that on Shaq? You could see that the referees were concerned about, hey, we've called too many fouls on him. We don't want him fouling out of the game. It was obvious.
Yeah.
And they never tried that experiment again. And then you had, of course, was it Tim? What was
Donahue?
It? Donahue, yes. And I was amazed the way the media handled it. They made him out to be just a lone nut type of, you know, he just, oh, this is just an extreme example. It's not, but it was so obvious that. That guy, should have broke the bank to say, hey, look, he basically said, these games are fixed. And we were talk a little bit about, you probably know more about his revelations than I do.
The Donahue case was really interesting because, you know, if it wasn't for the FBI, he'd still be in the NBA today. I firmly believe that. The FBI is who brought Donahue down, not the NBA. He was, I think, one of the top five rated NBA referees that the league had at the time. And the FBI, the only reason the FBI even found out about Donahue was the fact that they did a wiretap for some other mob-related investigation, and they heard someone say something about the fact of, oh, we got this referee working for us. And the FBI woke up and said, oh, what's this about? And it led to the whole Tim Donahue scandal. But the amazing thing to me was, like you said, you know, the NBA, after they got rid of Donahue, they didn't want him investigated or convicted for fixing games. And the FBI didn't need to investigate him or convict him of fixing games because they had him on all these other gambling charges. So the whole idea of him influencing the outcome of games for gambling purposes was dropped by both sides. And so Donahue today still says he never fixed the game, which a lot of people say, including myself, I don't believe that. I believed he was definitely fixing games because that's where he was making all the money gambling on the games in which he officiated. But he was doing such a good job officiating that to the NBA, he was a great official. But yet he was doing that great job while manipulating games for his gambling interests. So, I mean, it's just bizarre that, you know, afterwards, when everything broke and then Donahue came out and said, look, the NBA tells us officials how basically to, like you said, to fix games, how we're supposed to look for this foul or ignore this foul because we want to emphasize this and de-emphasize that. You know, we the referees understand what they're really getting at, and we manipulate the games at the NBA's request. Suddenly now, Donahue, he was a convicted felon, and we can't listen to him, and we can't believe him, and it should all go away.
Right, exactly. It just, I remember as being watching, for some reason, our area, even though I live in Northern Virginia, Maryland, when Lefty Driesell was there as a coach, because I think these college games are just as shady. They were in the ACC, obviously, and you know, I would watch a lot of their games. And you knew if you were going into Duke's home court or North Carolina's home court, especially those two, that almost every game you were going to probably have a deficit of 20 free throws at least. You know, in other words, they were going to call that many more fouls on the visiting team. And I've maintained you don't have to do anything beyond that because it's, if you know, those teams are fairly evenly matched at that level. it's hard to make up for like 20 free throws or more. And sometimes the visiting team would not even get a free throw attempt. You know, it's like, how is that possible? So, I mean, college is to me, the NCAA is a breeding ground for this, but I would think college games are at least as suspicious as the pro ones are.
Oh yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think I could fix a college basketball game today with the money I have in my bank account. And I don't have a lot of money in my bank account, I'll tell you that right now. But I think it's very easy to do because I think, you know, again, the student athletes still really aren't getting paid despite this whole, you know, NIL right. agreement type stuff. But so, I mean, I think you could easily approach them and say, hey, look, how would you like to make an extra $5,000 tonight, shave a few points or do this, that, or the other thing? And I'm sure many of them would be like, yeah, sure, okay, that sounds like a good plan. And same with officiating. I mean, you know, one of the things I did, which was a different book I wrote called Larceny Games, is I went to the FBI and through the Freedom of Information Act, got every file the FBI had related to game fixing in sports in the United States. And it was like over 400 files. And a lot of them had to do with college basketball and football. And it's amazing how much, you know, the FBI knew. Couldn't necessarily get convictions on, but I mean, some of the inside information that they got from bookies and from people within the NCAA, I mean, referees, especially in the NCAA college basketball, were really corrupt or were extremely corrupt. Mm-hmm. And like you said, I mean, I think it's something you still kind of see today. But again, nobody's looking for this. And that's my big problem with game fixing in sports because, you know, name me a crime that occurs everywhere in the world, but not in the United States. Right, I mean, name a crime. And the one crime that is that I can think of is game fixing, because you could pick a country around the world and you can find it in cricket. You can find it in soccer. You can find it in tennis. You can find it in boxing and badminton and ping pong and all these other sports. But here in the United States, no, it never happens here. It never touches our sports somehow. No, come on.
And our political leaders, when they're assassinated, it's never for political reasons.
True, that too.
Somebody's obsessed with Jody Foster. That serves as a good enough motive.
Yeah.
Here. In this country, but you're the person I've been dying to ask somebody because nobody seems to remember this but me. Do you remember when Irving Fryer spoke out in the 1990s about he was a wide receiver for the team formerly known as the Redskins, and I don't know why he spoke out at that time, but he just basically publicly said, you know, I was paid off in the 1983 championship game between Nebraska and Miami. And, you know, Fryer's the star receiver at Nebraska, and he did drop several passes in that game. And he said, and I was amazed at the time. So I said, uh-oh, hey, maybe finally somebody's finally talking. And literally there was crickets. They swept the story under the rug. When I'm searching online for it now, I can't find any references to it anywhere. And, but, you know, the first question any journalist should have asked was, well, wait a minute, who paid you off?
Yeah.
Nobody was interested. Do you know much about that story?
No, I vaguely remember that, though, now that you say that.
Yeah.
But I don't remember the details. And, it was probably one of those things that was just before my time enough that I didn't get into it. But, yeah, I do remember that. And, yeah, it's a crazy thing, like you say. But I've experienced that with my writing. I've experienced where they've killed stories. I've experienced where they've buried stuff. I mean, I found it fascinating that one of the things I uncovered for this book, Larceny Games, was that I had an legit FBI file that said – members of the New York Knicks in the early 1980s were shaving points as a favor to their cocaine dealer. And that the cocaine dealer went from betting $500 a night to over $10,000 a night. And he won like 8 of 9 bets. Okay. And so I put that in my book, and of all places, it got picked up in the New York Post. And the New York Post ran a story about it. And they basically confirmed everything that I wrote, put it in like a Sunday paper, and it went viral. It was the only thing of mine that really went viral. And it was everywhere, like, you know, ESPN. It was on Sports Illustrated, like CNN called my house. I don't know how they found me, but they called my house. It was everywhere. And the only place it did not go was ESPN. ESPN didn't touch a story, but ESPN was the broadcast partner of the NBA. Right. So why would they cover it, right? Yeah. So ESPN made it go away. And I think because it didn't get on ESPN in any way, shape, or form, the story kind of faded and died. I mean, it was a, you know, 30-year-old story anyway, but still – the fact of the matter that they wouldn't touch it, it just amazes me. Because, I mean, you could Google it today. You can type in, you know, New York Knicks cocaine game fixing, and you can see all the places it showed up, and it won't show up at ESPN because they never touched it. And I've had other things in similar fashion, too.
Well, I remember, I think, I know you were on the Dan Patrick show at least once, and I thought I saw you. So how, Is that the only time? I guess as he's associated with ESPN. Were you on at ESPN at all? Did they ever interview you about the fixes in?
No, they wouldn't touch it. Yeah. No, it's funny. I mean, I've done literally over, I don't even know how many anymore, over 200 interviews on radio, podcasts, and whatever over the past 10 years. Right. And I've been, like you say, I've been on the Dan Patrick Show. I've been on Coast to Coast AM and other like national broadcasts, but no ESPN major show. None. Not one in Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, Boston, none of their national shows. They won't touch me. And it's amazing. Like this book, like I said, I wrote this Fixes or Larceny Games book about these FBI files that I had. I mean, it talked about, and they were straight out of the files. I'm not making anything up, but they talked about literal Hall of Fame basketball and football players who the FBI knew were gambling on games in which they played. Whether or not they're fixing games is questionable, but they were definitely gambling on games in which they played. And so, I mean, these are guys who should literally be kicked out of the Hall of Fame for what they did. And I put all this in the book, straight out of the FBI files. And when the book was going to be published, my publisher was contacted by ESPN, Yahoo Sports. I had, you know, interviews with producers from 60 Minutes. HBO Sports was going to cover it. Sports Illustrated said they were going to put an excerpt from my book in their magazine at the time. And then crickets. Nobody did anything with it. Nobody reviewed the book. Nobody said, you should read this book. I mean, it was just like they got all this. They all got copies. They all looked at it. And then everybody said, we're not going to touch it. And then it all just disappeared. And nobody cared.
How did Dan Patrick treat you?
You know, the funny thing is they brought me on not to interview me. They brought me on because I wrote an article for Sports on Earth, which was about how I thought sports gambling should be legalized in the United States.
Oh, okay.
And so they wanted to talk about that. But the funny thing is, which worked out great to my advantage, was really early in the interview, I somehow was able to turn the interview into something about game fixing. And Dan Patrick picked up on that and he asked me questions. And so I totally changed the subject and he ran with it amazingly.
Oh.
And I even got him, I really think I got him to a point where he had no idea what to say. He was kind of like struck speechless by what I was telling him. Because I was talking about soccer and game fixing in soccer and how I said there was something like, at the time, I had just seen it, there were something like 50 different countries had game fixing investigations ongoing at the time of that interview. 50 different countries. And even Dan Patrick was just kind of like, whoa, maybe there's a problem in this.
Well, you were smart to mention soccer because that's kind of outside their purview. They probably listen to that.
Yeah. But it was funny because I was really proud of myself that I was able to turn that interview in the way I wanted it to really go. Yeah. And then it really got him to be like, wow, this is something different. Well, I'm not sure we should be talking about.
There's a book that's not like exactly like yours, but there's a guy named Jeff Benedict who wrote a couple books about sports. And
I've read his books. They were older, early 90s, I think.
I think it was Pros and Cons, one of those books. Yeah. And ESPN did have him on once, and I watched the interview. And you're probably lucky you didn't get that because they had they had everybody lined up against him. And they had one of the guys was John Mackey, who's, you know, a former Baltimore Colt tight end, and who Mackey basically threatened to come kick his ass on TV just because. So I said, well, I'm sure that would have happened to you because, you know, again, you're attacking their credibility. But how anybody can watch, you know, just look at just some of the things you see. I mean, I just look at the NFL. I keep telling myself if somebody would give me a team, all I would do to have an unstoppable offense is run the no huddle 2-minute offense nonstop. Yeah. Because it works. How many games do you see where a team can't move the ball, but in the last 2 minutes they go to the 2-minute offense, they go right down the field?
Yeah, like it was like never, no problem whatsoever. Yeah. There's no defense playing against them. Yeah.
So you mean to tell me the coaching staff say, hey, maybe we ought to be running this offense all the time? And then you had the prevent defense, which is one of the reasons why I guess it works, where every team they've got now decades worth of knowing that the prevent defense prevents you from winning, and yet they continue to go into it. Those are the kind of things I think, you know, I mean, I don't know if the coaches are all in on it. How do you think this works? Like, do you think that because sometimes I think it's just completely scripted, you know, theatrical. But other times I think they just need the officials and maybe here or there you can have a quarterback. But when coaches make those kinds of decisions, you have to wonder, are they in on it?
Well, they just made one this past week. I mean, if you saw the Browns-Packers game on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
You know, the Browns had the ball. They're at midfield. There was like a minute left in the game. They had all three timeouts.
Yeah.
And they had rushed for over 200 yards in the game.
Yeah.
I mean, which is a ton of yardage rushing. And so they had to get literally 15, maybe 20 yards to kick a field goal because they're down by 2 points, and they'd won the game.
Right.
And instead, they pull their star running back, Nick Chubb, and they run three straight pass plays, the third one of which got intercepted, which was actually a defensive pass interference call that went uncalled. But they ran three straight pass plays. They stopped running the ball. It was effective the whole game, 200 yards worth of rushing. You have three timeouts. You need to get 15 yards. And suddenly you go, well, whatever just worked, we're not going to do that.
Right.
We're going to do something. Well, that's either a coach thinking too much of himself, outthinking himself, or like you say, it's we're going to lose this game and this is how we're going to do it.
And of course, exactly. And of course, you have the betting aspect here, where how many, especially recently now with the 2 point conversions recently, Harbaugh of the Ravens. I call him Psycho Harbaugh because I think he's genuinely psychotic. The whole Harbaugh family, I think, is psychotic. If you've seen the father and all that, but I mean, they're all nuts. But this guy, he's lost two games recently by inexplicably going for a 2 point conversion at the end of the game instead of kicking the tying extra point. I mean, couldn't something like that just be point? Because how many bettors are upset when something like happens, so they lose by a point or something? And you know, those points, those half points matter. And like you mentioned, point shaving. And so knowing how important, I say, and look what just happened this last weekend as a fantasy football player who went undefeated in the regular season. And then I had all my team suddenly was out with COVID for the playoffs. So I got crushed. But I really think it's amazing that this COVID stuff struck right at that time. Because I think the NFL, especially the NFL, wouldn't exist. The only thing keeping it afloat is fantasy football and sports betting. I don't think people really.
Oh, on television.
The television contracts. But, when they do things like this, I mean, that's kind of, for instance, why the week before did they move those games to Monday and Tuesday when I think there were 16 players that tested positive for COVID? Yeah. But last week, the Houston Texans had 21 players. It's almost half their roster.
Well, the Saints just had 20.
Yeah,
who were 20. Out with COVID. Both their number one and number two quarterbacks, and they did nothing for them.
So, I mean, how do you expect that kind of inconsistency? But it's
that's the thing is the NFL, their thing they've been talking about for 50 years is integrity. This is all about integrity. We're all about integrity. And that's one of the reasons we have to keep gambling out of, the American public. We can't have legalized sports gambling because it's going to affect the integrity of the NFL. Well, then the Supreme Court overturns PASPA, which was the law that prevented states from legalizing sports gambling. So now sports gambling is on the board for every state, and states are legalizing it. And suddenly the NFL is like, we have official NFL gambling partnerships with FanDuel, with DraftKings, with Caesars, with all these other things. Now we're all open to gambling and integrity be damned. It's amazing how that works. And it's just like you say with the COVID thing. They said at the beginning of the season, we're not going to cancel or reschedule any games if teams get COVID. If you're going to have to deal with it or you're going to have to forfeit. And then here you come 2 weeks ago. Well, we got to reschedule three games because people got COVID. Well, again, where's your integrity? I mean, like you say, I mean, you can look at officiating. You can look at the, criminals who are allowed to play the game as athletes.
Yes.
Celebrated for what they do on the field, but forgotten about what they do off the field. I mean, all these integrity issues. And then people turn around and call me a conspiracy theorist because I say they might fix a game or two.
Right.
Integrity issues all over this league. Come on. And
that's why when people talk to me, when I talk about we have a state-controlled media, I just point to the world of sports and say, look, something like that. You're talking about sports, right? How is it? It's hardly significant. But they won't tell the truth about that. Jeff Benedict publishes his, books, one of them says 70% of the players in the NBA have a criminal record or whatever that thing was, one of his books, and they just blacklist him and they just ignore it or they smear him or pretend he's not there. Same thing with you put out a book about sports being fixed. Of course, they don't want to that reflects on their product when in reality they should be investigative journalists. This is a huge story. When Irving Fryer made his claims, every sports reporter should have been on his doorstep. Irving, give us the details. Nope. Said nothing about it.
I have to say, I did a thing where, I'll make a very long story very short. I got a tip that basically said this particular baseball game had been fixed, Major League Baseball game had been fixed. Mm-hmm. And I wound up working with Lance Williams, who was the co-author of Game of Shadows, which is the book about Barry Bonds and Balco and the steroid scandal. Mm-hmm. And Lance Williams worked for the Center for Investigative Reporting. And so he and I investigated this game-fixing story, which was just a crazy story where the Major League Baseball was able to get a local sheriff's department to hold this gambler's family at gunpoint, literally in the street, until they produced the gambler. And then they held him for until Major League Baseball showed up to interrogate this guy. And all this crazy stuff happened. But it was all true. So we did this whole investigative work. I mean, it took like a year to put the story together. And again, this is through the Center of Investigative Reporting, right? It seems like a pretty high up standard. And they go to ESPN and say, hey, ESPN, here's the story. And ESPN goes, yeah, no, we don't want that. And then they went to like a couple other outlets. Then they went back to somebody else at ESPN and said, hey, here's the story. And ESPN went a second time. Yeah, no, we don't want that. And it wound up taking us like 6 or 8 months to finally get it published in Sports Illustrated, who was kind of iffy about publishing it themselves. But I mean, here was this investigative piece that we worked really hard on about potentially the first fixed Major League Baseball game in 100 years, and nobody wanted it.
Yeah, no, they wanted it.
So, I mean, that's just like you say, that goes to show you what sports media is about. They're not about investigative reporting because they all fund it. ESPN funds the NBA, the NFL, Major League Baseball. Fox funds this. NBC funds this. I mean, they all fund these things. So why would they investigate what they're paying money to broadcast?
Exactly. And they've always played both sides of the aisle with gambling, because you go back to the Black Sox scandal, or what's, and you know, poor Shoeless Joe Jackson, who didn't even lay down, and he had a great World Series. Yeah. But, you know, he's banned from the Hall of Fame, third leading hitter in the history of Major League Baseball, third highest average. Buck Weaver, another guy who clearly didn't lay down, and they're banned. So they took it so seriously. And yet Pete Rose, you know, again, not the nicest guy in the world, but he has to be in the Hall of Fame, or you don't have a real Hall of Fame. How do you have somebody who had more base hits than anybody that ever played not in the Hall of Fame? He's out of for gambling when he was a manager. And, you know, unless Chuck Cocelli and I were talking about this last night, unless you can prove he was gambling against his own team, I don't see a problem with it. But I don't know.
See, I'll give you the argument. I'll give you the argument why he should not be in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
So it's two things. Number one, I interviewed John Dowd, who is the guy who did the investigation of Pete Rose when he was a manager. Major League Baseball thought and pretty much knew Pete Rose was gambling on baseball while he was playing in the early 1970s. And they did an investigation through on him and did all the stuff. And the problem was, is Pete was basically betting through intermediaries, and they couldn't prove it. So they dropped it and then literally destroyed all the records about him gambling. So when Dowd took over, when he was a manager, Major League Baseball actually told them that, yeah, we investigated him like, you know, 15 years ago for this. And John Dowd said, well, where is all that stuff? They're like, oh, well, we destroyed it all because it was, you know, too damning. Okay. But anyway, when Rose was a manager, here's what he would do is, yeah, he would bet on the Reds. But when he bet on the Reds, like if they were playing in a 3-game series, say, against the Cubs, he would bet on the Reds in game one. And then he would burn through his bullpen, burn through his bench, do whatever he could to win that game because he had bet on it. Mm-hmm. So then come game two, if he thought, you know, the Reds had an advantage, he'd bet on them again and do the same thing and burn through his roster just to win his bet. And then in game three, he would basically let the game go. He wouldn't bet on it. He wouldn't care what happened. He'd already burned through his roster, burned through his bullpen, and he would basically let the Reds lose that game. So in this fact, he actually did manipulate all three games in that series, and he also tipped off his bookie as to which games to bet on the Reds and which games not to bet on the Reds. And then he was manipulating games to make sure he won his bets, even though they were in his favor and his team's favor, but that at the other times, he was not trying to win games he didn't bet on.
Right. Well, I mean, again, it's obviously I understand, and I know Pete Rose isn't.
No, he's a.
It's kind of yeah, exactly. I mean, I understand he's a hard person to defend, but I just think that the league looks.
Well, if he was gambling on baseball in the 70s, he should have never broken Ty Cobb's record. He should have been kicked out of baseball in 1973.
Right.
We wouldn't even be having this problem. He would have been gone when he was.
Right.
I mean, and it's not, you know, it's not totally his fault, because if he had a true gambling addiction, you know, that's the way it goes. But that's the one rule that's on every, you know, locker room wall. Don't bet on baseball.
Right. Oh, yeah, exactly. No, and I understand the sports, but I think that's what it gets into the area where I don't have respect for any of these sports leagues, because they do care more about that than they care, for instance, about violent crimes against women or whatever. You know, because those players are always, I mean, you know, Aqib Talib and Pac-Man Jones, these guys weren't, especially Pac-Man Jones, they were not stars. and yet they got tons and tons of chances, no matter
how. Look at Antonio Brown right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
How is that guy in the league?
Yeah,
I mean, he just falsified a vaccine card.
Yeah, exactly.
And despite all the COVID stuff, the league didn't care enough about that. They suspended him, what, 3 games or something like that? Yeah. Whoop-de-doo. But then he's already being investigated for violent crimes outside, you know, with his, I forgot what it was, his maid or his housekeeper, and
he broke all sorts of other things. I think he broke his little boy's arm or something a few years back.
I mean, he had more than one incident, that's for sure.
Oh, tons. I mean, it's just amazing. They have an unlimited tolerance for that kind of stuff. So I just think when they try to, when they be sacrosanct about gambling, especially because they had, you know, remember going back to Jimmy the Greek Snyder. I mean, the fact that his whole reason for being on air, and I don't know how many years he was on for a long time on the NFL broadcast back with Brent Musburger in those days, back when CBS did the NFL NFC games. That was his reason for being there. He would do the point spread. Well,
I know.
Yeah, these were before all the sports betting houses were legal everywhere. So I used to say at the time, well, why is there, who cares about the point spread if it's not legal to bet on the games? But so they always kind of played it on both sides of the street.
Well, yeah, because like you said earlier, that's why people watch. I mean, it's a lot of it, especially with the NBA or NFL, it's the gambling, be it fantasy football or straight up gambling. And I mean, that's the other thing too. At the same time, you know, the networks are what keep the NFL alive. When you give the NFL like $7 or $8 billion a year, whatever it is now, to broadcast their games, it doesn't matter if anybody shows up in the stadium or not to see it. That $78 billion is going to keep them, you know, going just fine.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, when there's that much money, there obviously has to be corruption. And you know, again, it goes to the NCAA as well. But I want to you. I mean, you talk about NASCAR. I'm interested because. I believe NBA and NFL can be fixed just with the referees. The baseball, I think it's a little harder. I don't know how much impact and same thing with hockey.
You can do penalties, power plays.
Yeah, you can do penalties,
we've seen that.
Yeah, you certainly suspicious things, but there's no other power as the sport has the power like to call back a penalty for holding or something like that. Call back a touchdown for holding, something like that. But NASCAR, I'm interested. I'm not a NASCAR fan, but how would you fix NASCAR?
Well, like the old saying goes, you know, the reason they fixed horse races is because the horses don't talk.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing with NASCAR cars. The cars don't talk. So when you have things like, you know, restrictor plates, for example, you know, 1/32nd of an inch difference in one restrictor plate to another will alter the output of a car's engine and make one car faster than the other. So, you know, maybe you don't inspect one car as closely as you do the other cars. Or maybe, you know, certain drivers, you know, there's a legend in NASCAR called The Call, where NASCAR allegedly would literally call certain drivers and tell them, hey, today's not your day. I mean, it's not something I made up. It's something that's existed in NASCAR lore since the 1970s, I believe. So, I mean, they had this notion around in NASCAR for a very long time. And then, you know, you see certain outcomes that benefit certain sponsors, certain teams. I mean, a lot of people don't really realize if they don't follow NASCAR that even though there's 30 cars out there racing, there's only really like 8 teams potentially. And there's actually teams and drivers will help other drivers. And drivers have intentionally crashed to help other drivers. I mean, it's been proven that that's happened. And, you know, one of the most famous fixed NASCAR races ever was when Dale Earnhardt Jr. won. I think it was the Pepsi, I remember it was the Pepsi 400 or something like that, but it was the first race at Daytona after his dad died at Daytona earlier that year. And it was a prime time, the first broadcast NBC was going to have in prime time in NASCAR, and Dale Jr. wins this emotional big race, and everybody comes out and celebrates with him after the race. And literally after the race, the driver that came in second, third, and fourth all literally said, I was not going to pass Dale Earnhardt Jr. They basically said, we let him win.
Wow.
Yeah, if that doesn't tell you that NASCAR can be fixed, I don't know what else can.
Well, it's amazing. Now, obviously, you know, boxing, although it's amazing some people think boxing is, I mean, how long does that go back where, you know, you have boxing movies?
100 years.
The fact that's what I used to start every debate about sports being fixed with, okay, I'd start with wrestling. Okay, you don't believe wrestling. Of course not. That's ridiculous. Okay, well, how about boxing? They kind of have it all. you know, they kind of recognize it and say, okay, so, but it's being, you know, represented as being real, right? So when you have,
oh, well, it sort of is not, but sort of,
yeah,
is.
So, exactly. Well, I mean, it's look at something like you. I mean, Muhammad Ali when he was Cassius Clay. Yeah. I mean, he in the both Sonny Liston fights were questionable in my book, but the second one especially, the what they call the invisible punch, yeah, where he went down Phantom and that's punch. Phantom punch, yeah, and where Howard Cosell, that's where Howard Cosell burst to prominence and became kind of Clay Ali's sidekick. And Sonny Liston winds up dead a few years later, apparently, you know, refusing to throw any more fights. You know, they claim it was very suspicious, but that's the kind of world that's in. And how, you know, to me, that when you see that, or how about the Duran-Leonard fight, the No Mas fight, when yeah, Duran just walks out of a fight that was very boring. I was watching that fight. It was there was just nothing going on. He wasn't being dominated. It was ridiculous. And he got frustrated and walked off. No, in my mind, Duran, who was this guy had a pet lion. You know, he was uncontrollable. I think he was supposed to fall down, and he just in the middle of the fight said, no, refused to. And I think that was, yeah, but, you know, the
sports. That's what Jake LaMotta did.
Yeah.
I mean, in the movie Raging Bull, for people who've seen that, I mean, that's a legitimate thing that happened in his career. He was basically told to take a dive, and he wouldn't go down, but he just stood there and let the other guy beat him until the referee stopped the fight because he refused to actually go down.
Yeah.
But I wrote in my book, The Fix Is Still In, I wrote an entire chapter on how I think the three times Muhammad Ali won the heavyweight title, all three matches were fixed.
Absolutely. Yes.
Because, I mean, I think both Sonny Liston fights were fixed. And I don't even necessarily know that Ali was in on those fixes.
Yeah.
But I think Liston was taking a dive. I think when he beat George Foreman in the Rumble in the Jungle in the Congo, I think even Foreman to this day questions the outcome of that fight. He was the one who lost. He thinks he was actually, like, poisoned, believe it or not.
Yeah.
And caused that fight. And then when he lost to Leon Spinks, I mean, before he lost to Spinks the first time, Ali was literally walking around and asking people, what do you think would happen if I lost this fight? Yeah, you know, and then maybe I could come back and I could be the first person to ever win the heavyweight title a third time. Well, that's exactly what happened. And in fact, I have an FBI file that says a member of Spink's camp went to the FBI and said, hey, this fight's going to be fixed, just so you know. Wow. And if this and this happens, I'm going to come back to you. And, you know, we can go further with this. And the FBI reported all that. And exactly what the guy said was going to happen happened. And then the guy never came back to the FBI, and the FBI didn't bother to follow up on it.
Well, you just look at the backgrounds of these guys. I mean, you had Don King, who was a murderer, and I don't know, he must have had some big feet. He stomped a paraplegic to death. That was his murder, and I think he served 2 years in prison or something. Came out, and last I saw, he was like a flag waving Republican. I don't know how you do that, but he made that conversion. And then you have Bob Arum, very suspicious background as well. The people involved in the boxing world are so obviously oozing corruption. How does anyone take that world seriously?
You know, because there's money involved. Yeah. And I think that's part, and part of it too is who reports on this stuff again. You know, I mean, I think that's the big thing is that nobody talks about it. Nobody reports on it. They just is like, oh, here's a big heavyweight fight. Here's a big championship fight. Isn't this exciting? And all the other little stuff gets brushed aside and nobody pays attention to it unless they're a diehard boxing fan. But that's not what's going to be on ESPN. Sure. That's not what's going to be on Fox Sports. It's going to be the big heavyweight fights. And I think the same thing, in my opinion, goes for the UFC and mixed martial arts. I think the exact same thing happens there as it did in boxing, because that's how that world operates.
Yeah, well, I mean, you have people like, you know, Howard Cosell was always there. He was there at ringside during the rope-a-dope kind of, I think I see some strategy here. You know, he was the one, he's the only one that knew what was going on. I think Muhammad's got some strategy. It's like, what? You know, it's like, and Foreman, if people don't remember, George Foreman was like Mike Tyson. He was a monster. He had knocked out Joe Frazier, I think, in the second round, first or second round. He
seemed unbeatable.
He seemed unbeatable. And then to have this, but then you get, I don't know, I guess Foreman had to have participated in it because, you know.
Well, like you said, his argument, I saw there's an interview somewhere on YouTube with him about it. And he literally thinks that they did something to his water, because he said by like third round, all his energy was gone.
Yeah.
And he said it wasn't from throwing punches. He goes, I just felt like my arms were like dead and I couldn't lift them. I couldn't throw punches. I couldn't move like I wanted to. And he said the water tasted funny, tasted weird. And his own guy in the corner basically said, shut up and drink this.
And I've seen movies about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and to this day, that's his argument. He doesn't, even though, like I say, he was the guy who would have technically been the one taking a dive, he doesn't think he took a dive. He thinks he was, like you say, poisoned, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, well, that's incredible.
It affected him and cost him that fight. And he never got a rematch. He never got a second chance until he was way too old, and then those fights were total jokes when he was old and fat.
Yeah, he was not the young George Foreman was, if you've ever seen clips of that, it's the closest thing I've seen to Mike Tyson. Very, very, very taller Mike Tyson. Very similar. Just looked like a monster out there. It was, you know, unbeatable. But I want to go into, but we have time because this is winding down quick because there's so much stuff to discuss. Yeah. But what, give us an example of what you consider the greatest examples of sport fixed events in all sports or whatever sports you want to focus on.
Well, we talked about Super Bowl III. I think that's a big one.
Yeah.
And we talked about Jordan. But I think one of the interesting things that's happened recently is I call it the hashtag strong movement, mm-hmm. where you had certain, like, natural disasters occur, and then the sports teams affiliated with that city or that region suddenly became champions.
Yes.
I mean, you had Hurricane Katrina, and then the Saints brought back the city, and they won the Super Bowl, like, 3 years later. And then you had, like, the Boston Marathon bombing, and then everybody became Boston Strong. And that same year, the Red Sox won the World Series, and the Bruins made it to the Stanley Cup Finals. And then you had another hurricane that hit Houston, and Houston became Houston Strong, and Houston won the World Series. And then you had even the Las Vegas Golden Knights. After that shooting at the country music festival, they became Vegas Strong, and this expansion team with a bunch of nobodies made it to the Stanley Cup Finals that year. And it's funny because those are the only incidents. You can't find an incident where some city became, you know, like hashtag Chicago Strong and didn't make it to the finals.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's very interesting how that all played out for all those
teams. Wasn't the Patriots' first Super Bowl victory after 9/11.
9/11. Right. That'd probably be the first one, but they didn't have the hashtag thing.
Right, they didn't have the hashtag, but still, that was where they came from. Brady suddenly emerged after Bledsoe got hurt, and the rest is history. But that's a good point. And I think I remember the New Orleans Super Bowl, especially where Peyton Manning, boy, I mean, if somebody was ever in on those, he's one quarterback I wondered about, because he was the greatest regular season quarterback I've ever seen, but man, he would get in that postseason and that pick six. Pick six he threw in the Super Bowl against the Saints, boy.
And the funny thing is, I mean, if anybody had a connection to the Saints, it wasn't Drew Brees, who was the Saints quarterback. It was Manning, whose dad was Archie Manning, the quarterback of the New Orleans Saints. He grew up in New Orleans. I mean, come on, Peyton had more connection to that city than anybody. And like you said, to me, it looked like he threw that Super Bowl. That's my opinion, but it looked like, and literally threw it when he threw that pick six, like you say, toward the end of the game, that sealed the deal for him. But then he gets rewarded, because then Super Bowl 50 is the great, you know, Peyton Manning retirement party. I mean, that's all it was about, is here's Peyton going off into the sunset. But, you know, was that a payoff for throwing that other Super Bowl? Could be. I mean, why not? He seemed like a company man more than anybody else, so maybe that's what it was.
Yeah, well, you can't help but wonder. I mean, it's there's so many of these suspicious storylines, and when you have what do you think in the NBA? Like, I mean, you had Michael Jordan's last minute shot, won one championship. Steve Kerr's won another. I don't know. Or do you just think those entire series were because you had last second victories in two of those championships they won? I don't know.
Those are hard because, I mean, you wouldn't, if you're going to fix something, usually you don't have it come down to the final second.
Right,
I mean, that's a little too close for comfort.
Right, you don't think they make it,
Yeah. But, I mean, that one, the final shot with Jordan where he, like, almost, like, posed for photographs afterwards kind of makes you wonder, too. Because I think that was the final championship they won, and he just kind of stood there with his arm up, you know, and everything for, like, everybody to get their picture before, you know, it was over. But, yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of things in all these leagues that should make people wonder what the heck's going on, because I don't think it's legitimate. I don't think it's all professional wrestling. I don't think every game is fixed. But when all these mechanisms are in place for these leagues to legally fix the outcome of games, I think and that's the best business decision the league can make sometimes, to have certain outcomes happen. I think you're naive to think that there's no way it could happen.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, they call these leagues copycat leagues, but you don't see teams go against the grain very much. They're all very. Maybe one team does, and then people start copying them. But for the most part, they don't. And so, if you see something like Moneyball, in baseball, where if that seems to work, but why don't other teams employ that? Because, I mean, I especially in the NFL, I know there are tons and tons of gems out there. I mean, look at Tom Brady. You know, the people are the most people. One of the things the NFL hides very clearly is every one of its drafts, probably 90% of the first round picks are huge busts every year.
Yeah, they're failures.
Yeah, they're failures, and they just for and yet they always, when they're grading these teams' drafts, they give every team an A.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, they did a great job. Oh, I know they didn't do a great job, but how about sports like tennis? I mean, I go back to the Bobby Riggs and Billie Jean King thing. A lot of people think that was a politically motivated fix, thing, something like that. But sports like tennis, golf, are they possible to fix?
Golf, I think, would be a very tough one. Because I think that's because it is all individuals. You, I mean, again, I wouldn't say impossible, but like baseball, very difficult to fix. Tennis, on the other hand, it's ripe with corruption. I mean, it's like boxing because a lot of it is one-on-one matches. So if you get one person willing to take the dive, you got a done deal. And the scary thing with like in-game betting that is starting to spread more and more is a lot of times these people aren't necessarily fixing an entire match. But what they'll do is they'll fix like game two of the second set. Mm-hmm. That's how specific they'll be. They'll be like, all right, just tank this one particular game in this particular set. We'll bet heavily on it. And then the rest of the match can go whatever way you want it to go. But we're going to focus on that one thing. And that's the sort of thing that's impossible or nearly impossible to spot. And then, you know, figure out what happened and arrest the people who were fixing that match or what have you. But that's what it's coming down to is all these little spot fixes and that sort of thing. But yeah, tennis is bad. Like soccer's bad, you know, like rugby's bad, cricket's bad. There's a lot of corruption in those international sports.
Yeah, it's a shame that sports have to come down to that. But have you gotten anybody inside, any players, has anybody reached out to you? And
no,
off the record,
unfortunately.
No. Okay. I was
hoping it's getting into a bummer. Yeah. I mean, there was one guy, he didn't reach out to me, but I can't remember his name. His last name might have been Jackson, but he played on the Super Bowl, the last Super Bowl, the Buccaneers one, not the one with Tom Brady, but the one with John Gruden was the coach.
Right.
And he was interviewed, was it last year or the year before, on the Tampa Bay radio station, and he literally told these two hosts that the NFL was decided off the field. The games were decided off the field, and they weren't decided on the field, and that the best team didn't win, that there was manipulations going on. And both radio hosts were just like totally struck by it. They're like, what are you talking about? And he's like, dude, if this is what you think happens, you're totally nuts. I mean, the player was just going on and on about how literally games were decided off the field and that they were fixed.
Maybe he read your book.
And it's something you can find. You can look around on YouTube and you can find it. Cause it's a bizarre, like 10, 12 minute interview because I mean, the guy, I think, is totally speaking the truth, but the hosts are just baffled by it.
Well, the
it's really interesting to hear.
Well, the fix is obviously an eye-opening book. And I want to give you the last minute and a half to give out any links or tell people how they can contact you, anything you want to promote.
Yeah, sure. If anybody does want to contact me or reach out to me or find my books, the best place to go is my own website, which is thefixisin.net. And you can buy my books directly from me. You can buy them on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and wherever good books are sold. And like I said, if people want to contact me, send me emails, ask me questions, my contact info is all on there.
Do you have a new book on anything you want to promote?
The latest book I did was The Fix Is Still In, which is kind of a sequel to The Fix Is In. It's a little different, but along the similar veins. And that just came out about 2 years ago. And that's... it's a good place to start, same as The Fix Is In. It's, I think, like you say, if you're a sports fan and you're willing to take your fan hat off and listen to a little bit of reason, a little bit of logic, it will totally change the way you consume sports.
Absolutely. Well, you know, with everything else being corrupt and everything, to think that these billion-dollar industry, or whatever, how much money is involved in
multi-billion.
The world of sports, multi-billion dollar industry, to think that they would leave that alone is... I think very naive. Brian Toohey, great work. Keep up the great work. We'll have to have you on again because there's so much we can talk about just on this one subject alone. You've written other books as well. So check out his work at thefixisin.com, right?
.net.
Thefixisin.net. Check it out. Brian Toohey, thanks so much for being with us. We'll be right back after these words.
Thanks, Don.
In a time of fake news, fake politicians, and fake fiat currency, it's getting harder to find the genuine article. That's why when it comes to precious metals, I call the team I can trust. This is David Knight for my friends at Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange. Proudly veteran-owned and operated, Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange is your home for gold and silver coins, bullion, jewelry, and more. Prices and inventory are updated daily, so you get the most competitive possible pricing. And when it's time to sell your gold and silver items, they pay top dollar. Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange also accepts and deals in Bitcoin. Call or text the owner, Tony Arterburn, today at 888-667-1836. That's 888-667-1836. Or just go to wisewolf.gold. From bullion to Bitcoin, Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange.
Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange.
Hi, this is Cindy Sheehan. You're listening to The Donald Jeffrey Show.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Do you like history? Real history that you were never taught in schools?
Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia.
By author Mike Swanson, with new documentation never seen before. That'll open your eyes to events that led up to this.
Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia, 1945 through 1961.
Get your copy today at Amazon.com.
Why? The Vietnam War
by author Mike Swanson.
Hi there, this is John Barber, and you're listening to the most informed man in America, my friend, fellow author, and raconteur, the great Donald Jeffries Show.
Go ahead, caller.
Hey, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right, well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, he knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now, has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com, enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the
great information. Well, I was sitting around my house. Oh, and as I looked around, you know the worries in my life are sure to bring me down, because I try so hard to be all of the things said for me, but your shoes are so hard to fill. Yes, living in your shadow is hard for me. But well, I'll be alright if you hold me through the night. Put your loving arms around me, yeah, make everything alright. Whoa, I'll be alright if you hold me through the night. No, this journey won't be.
Ocelli.com.
Revelation through conversation. You are listening to the Donald Jeffries Show.
And welcome back to the Donald Jeffries Show. Hope you guys like Brian Toohey. Another aspect of my personality, if you've known me back in the 70s and 80s, it was one of the things I talked about quite a bit, how sports are fixed, everything's fixed. I kind of carried that into many aspects of life. It's all fixed. Had a whole crowd of us that used to talk like that. But yeah, the phone lines are open, so I'd love to hear from you guys. The number to call is 319-527-5016. Again, 319-527-5016. So we'd love to hear, love your calls. So anything at all, you want to talk about anything, we'll entertain all subjects here. So let's see. I think the big story in the news right now that, well, it's in our news. It should be the top story in the news, but it's being ignored studiously by the state-controlled media, as has been the entire time, is the trial of Ghislaine Maxwell, who, according to Chuck, my inside source Chuck Ocelli, has told me that she was just found guilty on 5 or 6 charges, which kind of amazes me. But we'll see what actually happens to her in terms of punishment. But, you know, a lot of us said when she was arrested set for prosecution, we said, okay, maybe this is they can't possibly allow her to talk. They can't let this stuff come out because, again, there's so many big names involved here. Both Clinton and Trump, Prince Andrew, you know, the people, you know, top people in Hollywood, Oprah Winfrey, tons of these people were all involved and, you know, friends with this guy, friends of Jeffrey, who went on the Lolita Express, went to Lolita Island. Just, you know, it's one of those things that could really bring things down. So I knew it would never, you know, be allowed to come forth, but I don't quite know how they managed to convict her. I, you know, had to read the trial transcripts, I guess, because, again, it got no coverage at all in the press whatsoever. They literally ignored the story. But I don't think, as far as I know, it seems like she, you know, vigorously denied the charges, didn't sing like a canary, didn't sing at all. So, shockingly, all the powerful people in the world have nothing to worry about in terms of that. And our press is certainly not going to hold their feet to the fire. I just got done watching a 3-part thing, I think, called Chasing Ghislaine, that was done by a British reporter on the Investigation Discovery Network. And it was pretty good. I mean, they mentioned all the key players, but this was, of course, before her trial. But it's interesting to see that once again, the elite have managed to not have their the skeletons in their closet exposed. I mean, they'll get her convicted to whatever degree she is convicted. You know, sometimes I think these big players, whether it's Epstein, you know, he certainly didn't kill himself, but either he was really murdered or he was whisked off stage. I think that happens to a lot of these people, and I think that may be happening to her. She may be said to go into prison, but I don't know. She may be whisked off to whoever Jeffrey Epstein is and some of these other people. But you get jaded on that because it's when you read about the kind of things he was doing and the power he had and the powerful people that were involved, it makes you sick that he can do that. And you have people like Alan Dershowitz, who is, by the way, wasn't he one of Trump's lawyers for a while, by the way? I mean, Dershowitz has gone from the far left to supposedly being a conservative. I don't know what he is, but Dershowitz was actually named himself by one of the accusers, the one that her name escapes me at the minute, but moment, but the blonde haired girl who was when she was, you know, a teenager, underage teen, was photographed with Ghislaine Maxwell smiling behind them like a Cheshire cat with Prince Andrew with his arm around her. And of course, you know, I hear him say, "Hey, well, that's me. I can't acknowledge me, you know, but I don't know if that's my hand, you know." It's like, you know, so somebody photoshopped it. It's amazing. These elite, they suddenly believe in conspiracies then. Oh, that's Photoshop. You know, I could have done that. That's right. Mention AD too much. And say, exactly. And I know nothing about Dershowitz or anybody else. I'm just saying that these people invariably get off and they're above the law. And it's one of the many problems we have in this country is our justice system is not for the anybody with any wealth at all is completely above. And I know Chris is out there. Chris Graves wants me to write a book on the justice system. I may still do that. I had started it. I have a lot of material for it, but there's a book there. I just don't know. I think it would be like Survival of the Richest and Bullyocracy. I just don't know if anybody would read it because people are just amazingly jaded. They don't want to look the corruption in the face. And to understand one big aspect of our problems is to understand how bad that justice system is. And I'm talking about from top to the bottom. This is I wrote a book on it. It would be incorporated in everything. So it would go from police corruption, from police at the scene, arresting the wrong people, planning evidence, doing the kind of things that we know they do. And of course, not all the time. But the fact that they ever do it is troubling. And we know they do. So we know that in some cases, some people that end up in prison were completely framed from the very beginning, or the police literally, and they've been caught on film planning, you know, cocaine and things like that on them. And it's unconscionable that that could possibly happen, but you go from the next step. The next step is once the prosecutor gets a hold of it, and that's why you have so many people sitting in prison with even when DNA evidence has exonerated them, they take forever to release them because they don't want to admit they were wrong. They you know, staked everything in these cases, and once they come up with a suspect, this is why, you know, the police are stubborn and they don't want to ever admit they're wrong. They don't want to look in another direction. And so once they have their suspect, they know they have their guy, and they try to force the evidence to fit it. And lots of people who didn't commit the crimes end up being convicted of it. Sometimes they're very long sentences. Because again, of course, you factor in the corrupt judges and you factor in the inept defense counsel. Again, as I talked about in Hidden History and Survival of the Richest, both the vast majority of people that are prosecuted for crime are poor or working class at best. Really, almost no middle class people get charged. Our prosecution system is basically, it serves to just, you know, go after poor people. And prisons are not for anybody but poor people, and they can't afford attorneys. So what happens is they get a public defender, and most public defenders spend less than 5 minutes with their client. And those 5 minutes consists of trying to work out a plea deal. You know, you can say, I didn't do it all I want. Doesn't matter. There's definitely a book there. Peter C. Kosh, great to see you in the chat room, my friend. Speaking of Epstein, Maxwell, have you ever considered having Sean Atwood on your show? He's an expert on the subject, and he writes a good book. I need to do that because apparently I can't get Whitney Webb, who wrote a book on Epstein. I would love to have her, but Whitney was on my iProtest show a couple times. I don't know what happened. I must have fallen out of favor with her. She hasn't answered my messages for a long time. So, yeah, I have to look into that. So that would be a good idea. Vitelli says, wonder if Opperman would do Don's show. He probably would. I've been on his show many times. I don't know. You know, Ed probably has talked about his career as a PI, a private investigator, and all he worked on the OJ case, and he's known lots of, celebrities out there. I think he worked on Robert Blake's things. Obviously interesting guy. Chris says, supposedly Stallone took Wepner's life story for Rocky. I noticed you guys were having some interesting discussions in the chat room about boxing and other stuff. But so anyhow, that's the Maxwell story. Looks like it's going to go out with a whimper, not a bang. And I don't think we're going to have any explosive revelations. And it's a shame because once again, the establishment dodges a bullet and they can continue to smear people. So when some of us talk about these child sex scandals or child sex trafficking, they can just say Pizzagate, or something like that, so just to belittle us. And no question, ever since the late great Dave McGowan wrote Pedophocracy, which is still out there online, I think. He was the first one that I know of that really went after this big time online. Of course, you had John DeCamp, the Franklin scandal, which I wrote about in Hidden History. And I had Lauren Schmidt, who's still alive, 90-some years old, at former state senator. I had him on iProtest last year. Great guest. Still sharp. And he talked about all the people that died that was associated with it. Just when you look at that case, you realize how big this stuff is, because that was – the Franklin Credit scandal was an example of corruption on a massive scale in just one part of one state, Lincoln, Nebraska. And, of course, Warren Buffett happened to be there, so he was kind of, nibbling around the edges of that as well. But you realize how big this thing is, because imagine if Nebraska can be that big in terms of child sex trafficking and big players involved in it, big newspaper publishers, chiefs of police. If that can happen there, what's happening in New York City? What's happening in L.A.? And I think that's when you understand the extent of the problem there. Chris says, Whitney Webb is hanging around with Tim Dillon and Joe Rogan these days. Oh, isn't Tim Dillon the guy that you said is a fan of mine, Chris? Or am I get that mixed up? Is it somebody else? Who was it you said was a fan of mine? Tim Dillon, I can't remember what the guy's name is. Maybe it was somebody else. I get him mixed up with somebody else. But yeah, Whitney's doing really well. And again, I think, you know, Whitney does real good work. But I have a chip on my shoulder about people that don't get back to you. And I don't like that. I think it's rude. Anybody that contacts me, I get back to them. Especially if they're asking to interview me, it's unthinkable that I would just ignore them. Wouldn't do that. Yeah, see, okay, Chris, thank you. Dillon, that's wonderful to hear that. So, well, hopefully maybe he'll mention me. Maybe she'll badmouth me and he won't be a fan anymore. I don't know. And didn't you say Chris said he heard Joe Rogan knows about Hidden History or likes Hidden History or something, which is astounding to me. That would be, obviously, Joe Rogan's got the biggest podcast in the world. And Dillon has mentioned Dave McGowan a bunch on Rogan, too. Cool. So, you know, I'm trying to perpetuate Dave's work as much as I can. Just, you know, obviously our names are mentioned together a lot online. And if you read On Borrowed Fame, my new book, you'll see I mention him quite a bit. I was indebted to his work on Bobby Fuller and many, many other issues, many other parts of Laurel Canyon. Rogan knows Hidden History. Yes, wow, that's cool. Well, maybe one day he'll complicate me. Ed's worked on lots of stuff, kind of on the Rocky thing with Chuck, never went much. Yeah, he's and Ed always has. I notice him when he's on social media. He always seems like he's on the brink of something big. Like I'm about to sign a radio show or something. It never seems to happen, but he's right maybe on the brink of it. But hey, he's a good guy, obviously. And I've been on his show many times. He's been a supporter of mine. I know we don't agree on everything, but. He's certainly been supportive of my work. But so we had the Glenn Maxwell thing, and then we have the continuing nonsense. I touched on it a little bit in terms of how it's even impacted the sports world. But this thing, you know, today I went to a funeral for one of the best friends I ever had in my life, Joe Burton. And ironically, when we're talking about sports being fixed, he would have loved this show because he was my best friend back at that time. And he's probably the first person I swayed to my side about sports being fixed. We used to call each other up all the time. You see that play? Did you see? Thoroughly convinced everything was fixed. So I don't know, some of you out there aren't old enough, but, you know, I'm old enough now where I'm burying friends and I've lost too many of them. And it's very sad. He suffered from Parkinson's for about 20 years. Fate could have been a lot kinder to him. So I'm a little bit depressed today because of that. But I being around everybody there at the funeral again, I realized again how I'm in such a minority because, you know, I don't want to wear my mask. I don't want to do it. And of course, I'm the only unvaccinated person there. And I just hear the little. You know, chatter, you know, from people saying, they say, you know, this is really, you know, this is, their symptoms aren't bad, but this, again, they're talking about colds, people. People have always gotten colds, sore throats, runny nose, cough. I mean, this is no mystery. This is no plague. But, and they're saying, but the good thing about it is, you know, it may protect you from the Delta variant and all this. And I just bite my tongue. I want to pay respects to my friends, but it's just the stupidity is overwhelming. Thank you, Chris. I appreciate that. Losing people's worse. Yes, it is. And it's, you know, I had to. We all have a certain number of friends, but of the closest friends I've had in my life, I know three are gone. And and as far as I know, you know, it's probably more, you know, because you lose touch with friends, you don't see them for a long time. And it shows you how fleeting things are. And I found out, you know, when I was fired after working at that largest healthcare institution in the East Coast for my entire adult life, 44 years, when I was fired unceremoniously for helping out a handicapped coworker 3 years ago, I discovered again, I didn't really have any friends there. You know, I thought I had tons of friends, but I didn't hear from anybody. And it's kind of like when you're in school. You know, you leave high school and you think that you're going to hear from those people, your friends, and you never hear from them again, for the most part. It's the same kind of thing that happens in the workplace. You discover that a lot of those friends are just acquaintances. But Joe Burton was more than that, and so we stayed friends for a long time. And a couple of the others I've lost. Same story. So it's hard. I understand. I didn't understand for a long time, you know, that expression. You look like you lost your best friend. Well, when you actually lose your best friend, it's pretty tough. Exactly, Chris. Remember, they wouldn't even let them have wakes and funerals. Well, it's absurd now. The funeral parlor last night, when I went in for the viewing, you know, the guy told me at the door I had to put on a mask. And I wanted to say, you know, really, what, to protect the corpses? I mean, you know, this is absurd. But, you know, of course, I put it on out of respect to his family. Yes, they did claim they had prisoners digging graves in New York. Absolute bullshit. Rikers Island. I'm sorry to hear that, Chris. My grandfather couldn't have a funeral. Yeah, and it's fortunately, I'm glad my mother-in-law died right before this pandemic hit, because she wouldn't have been able to have a ceremony either. And that's just, I think that's awful, you know, for people. But it's just one of the many things that, I don't think we're ever going to recover from this, because the people that people like us that are awake, that understand how absurd this narrative is, I'm going to have a hard time forgetting all the stupid things that were said to me, and these stupid inferences that were made by family members and friends, alleged friends. I'm not going to forget that. If we get world ever regains the sanity, because then you saw how easily they can be manipulated, and you. You realize, wow, you know, they, you know, just desperately. I mean, just how many people have gone unhugged, unkissed in this thing? And, you know, they used to have that guy, this Italian guy, he used to be on all the talk shows, Oprah and everything back. I can't remember what his name, but he's Hug Therapy. And he would come on and make a big production out of hugging everybody. And I thought that was a pretty cool idea. I like hugs. I think they're important. And something, you know, again, seems to me to have been lost. When it's discouraged, we can't do that. And I don't know, we're entering in very dark territory. Obviously, people heard me talk about it a lot, but it doesn't show any signs of ending. And if they go through, at least in my area, they're talking about in early January. I know my daughter was talking about the bars in D.C. They're going to require you to have a vaccination pass to go in any of them. So, again, that's going to be one more thing the unvaccinated can't do. And so I really feel sorry for especially the young unvaccinated males, especially out there. They're having a hard time as it is meeting anybody. How difficult must it be now, especially if you're going to be banned from places if you don't get vaccinated? So this is a tragedy, what's going on. And I'd say if we ever regained our sanity, we would look back on this as another Salem witch trials type moment. But I don't know that we're ever going to regain our sanity. Said I accidentally overheard Dr. Phil giving out gifts to people who both vaccinated and masked. I'm not sure about that. And again, that number is Chuck is reminding us 319-527-5016. So hopefully there'll somebody will call in before the last minute or so we can have time to talk. 319-527-5016. Again, love your phone calls. I love the interaction in the chat room. I appreciate you guys being in there. You can definitely throw questions out there, comments out in the chat room. So, again, the question is that we're going on 2 years now. I first started writing about this and being canceled by family and friends back in, I think, April 2020. That's when. So we're getting close to the 2-year mark here. And, it's gotten incredibly old, but it's, you know, unfortunately, as I saw today, just listening to those people, and they're intelligent people. Shouldn't be that easy to fool. Falling for this and saying, oh, thank goodness. And it's very much like you saw, again, there's so many analogies to Orwell's 1984. Go back and read that again and listen to some of the dumb, you know, dumb party members or the people, the stuff that they were able to believe. The doublethink and everything. And it's that sounded so much like to me what Orwell is talking about. You know, they say, thank goodness, the good thing, the upside is that this is not, the symptoms aren't bad here. And so it'll protect you from the Delta variant. It's like I'm just sitting there. My head is swimming thinking, what are you talking about? As someone said, newspeak, absolutely, too. Doublethink and newspeak both. But I mean, doublethink is especially prevalent now, though, because, you know, doublethink is the ability to juggle two diametrically opposing views at the same time without any inconsistency. So if you – it's the ultimate doublethink when you have people getting a vaccine, then a second vaccine, then a third vaccine, getting COVID, getting a booster – and still demanding that everyone else get vaccinated. Well, of course, our first response is you've had three shots, you've had a booster, and yet you've got COVID. Why should I take a vaccine? It's not going to protect me against this. But they're managing to put in their minds the conflicting, contrasting thoughts that the vaccine is all crucial. It can protect everyone with the fact that, well, it's another breakthrough case. And, you know, I've heard him say, you know, the vaccine doesn't stop you from getting COVID. Okay, then why are we getting it? I mean, it's the first vaccine in the history of the world that doesn't do what you want it to do. It's very troubling that people are willing to suspend their critical thinking like this. Israel's giving out the fourth shot jab, absolutely. And Israel's one of the worst places for this. I think they have a mandate to go in malls, to go shopping anywhere, you have to show vaccination status. I mean, it's just talking about show me your papers. People forget about the original strain and the Delta strain. Yeah, exactly. The strain, you know, it's like, and what happened to COVID-20? Where's COVID-21? We're still stuck on COVID-19. You know, these things are supposed to be different every year, slightly different. Absolutely unbelievable. And Chelly is giving the official definition. I guess this is newspeak, an official or semi-official style of writing or saying one thing and the guise of its opposite, especially in order to serve a political or ideological cause while pretending to be objective, as in referring to increased taxation as revenue enhancement. Absolutely. Or one of the great examples of that was Ronald Reagan, one of his missiles that he was promoting, he called it the Peacekeeper. So, you know, that's a beautiful description of it. But we've all, you know, and that you were talking about going back, you know, almost 40 years there. People have become accustomed to that, and they're willing. They're so drenched in newspeak and doublethink that they really they don't know any other way. Patriot Act, Chris says, yes, absolutely. Who other than Tulsi Gabbard? I don't know of any public official who has come out publicly like for abolishing the Patriot Act. Nobody does. Especially now that terrorists are pretty much, unless you want to, you know, count the domestic terrorists that are going to school board meetings, the terrorists that we were fighting the war against, they've disappeared. You know, thank goodness COVID defeated them, because we don't see them anywhere now. So why do we need this Patriot Act? But of course, they would say we have to turn it on the new terrorist. You know, the people that are criticizing the government or whatever you want to call it. Very troubling times, you know, and if you listen to my appearances every Monday on Jeff Rentz, I mean, it brings out probably the most pessimistic side of me. And, they're obviously, you can't help but be pessimistic. As Ambrose Bierce, one of my favorite writers, said, you know, this is pessimism is a condition forced upon the observer. And it's true. You can't look around. And I mean, when you see just the senselessness, just going out and about, and now that never before in history was it so apparent. You know, it used to be when you went out into a store or an event, a movie or something, restaurant, you didn't necessarily know like how many people were might be awake there or what, you know, what views these people might have. I mean, you couldn't really tell, right? Now you go out and it's written very clearly. Because you figure that almost everybody that is wearing that mask is buying this narrative, is buying the greatest PSYOP in the history of the world. And the ones you see that are, they're by to different degrees. And certainly you see the ones that I see, a lot of them all the time, that are in their cars by themselves with a mask on. You know that person's bought it completely. And it's disillusioning to see how badly we're outnumbered. I knew we were outnumbered. But you'd think after 2 years of this stuff, we would have gained some recruits on our side, that more people would be fed up with us. But no, the margin hasn't grown, and we're stuck with however many people are not vaccinated. I don't know. You hear again, both sides manipulate the numbers. Who knows? All I know is that almost everybody I know in my family is vaccinated. And everybody I know in my family, except for myself and my son especially, wear the masks and will probably get vaccinated if they have to. So very troubling, because how do you defeat something when you can't get people to think at all, especially after 2 years, and the information has been out there, and you can hold your fingers in your ears and go, nah, you know, I don't want to hear it. But some of us have been talking about it for 2 years. We've told you about the CDC directive to hospitals that orders them to list the cause of death as being from COVID, even when they weren't tested. You've seen which John Rappaport first revealed on my show, I Protest show, right at the beginning of this pandemic, that every one of those weekly updates from the CDC contains a little clause with an asterisk next to it saying, note, contains presumptive cases. In other words, their numbers have always contained and included people that weren't tested. And that's even going above and beyond the tests themselves. And we know these tests have always been flawed, to say the least. We've heard things about 90% false positive rates, and the PCR tests have never used the numbers right. It's absurd. These tests are not accurate whatsoever. And as somebody who said, you know, you want to end this, there are two great memes that have been, they used to say, you want to end this pandemic, turn the TV off. And the new thing is, you want to end the pandemic, just stop testing. Everyone will go back to having colds, because people act as if that there wasn't a flu. And by the way, the flu's back. It disappeared last year for some reason. Nice of it to take a winter off. But there's always been the flu. There's always been. Do people have that short memories that they don't realize how? And now they panic so much. If someone has a sniffle, oh, you can't come around. I can't be around you. And I've seen it. My own family, you know, people not getting together on holidays and so forth because of this absurd hysteria. And it's shameful that people are so incapable of thought. But this is decades worth of brainwashing and watching that stupid boob tube and, you know, believing it's absurd. Okay, we have a caller now. Caller, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, it's Jimmy James calling from Guitar Town.
Jimmy, how's it going?
Pretty good. Good show.
Thank you, sir. What's on your mind?
I was... so many things. Do you have any news on this Harvard professor that was arrested for taking Chinese money?
I didn't hear that. Tell us about that. I don't know about that.
Well, they're going out of their way to not talk about it, but a Harvard professor who's advising on this corona stuff, oddly enough, he was arrested not for taking money from China, but not for mentioning it.
Interesting. Yeah. If it doesn't appear on the conspiracy websites, or people don't tell me on shows like this, I'm not aware of it, because I don't, unless it's Tucker Carlson, I still watch him sometimes, but I grow tired of that sometimes as well. But that's the only kind of news I watch ever. Other than that, I watch, old movies on TV. But what do you think? How's it? I don't know what area you're in, where you're at. How are the mask mandates and all that stuff? What's it like where you're at? And if you don't mind, where are you at?
Well, I'm in northern Michigan, mm-hmm. and we've completely ignored it altogether pretty much since the beginning.
Wow, very cool. Well, you must be
no
dropping.
Wears a mask up here.
Well, you must have lost half your population then. Geez, with no masks.
To hear the news tout, they must be stacking them up like kindling in back of the house. But COVID's through the roof.
Well, I mean, is there, do you have a lot of Karens and everything? Do you have a lot of people that are hysterical about the fact that people aren't wearing masks? You must have some people in the area that are clinging to this fantasy, or is this a whole awake area?
Yeah, we've never been real big on obeying government orders, I guess you could say.
Good for you. Well, that's maybe that what made you what you are. That's great. That's great to hear that there are pockets like that. Because I, you know, here in the Northern Virginia suburbs outside of D.C., man, I'm a needle in the haystack. I'm outnumbered. I was at the post office again this week mailing some books, including checks, and I was. I was just irate because there was only, first of all, everybody had a mask on but me. It was really crowded, and they only had one line open. So, of course, I started ranting about how long does the line have to get before you give some more help out here? And, of course, everybody else is sitting there and saying nothing. But I'm amazed they didn't have somebody like you. So I guess you saw that video of the Karen on the airliner that punched the 80-year-old guy after demanding he put his mask on. I'm surprised I don't have people doing that to me because most of the time I'm the only one without a mask. So, you're fortunate.
That is odd. See, I guess so. I mean, see here, you can always tell when someone's from out of the area because they are wearing masks.
Mm-hmm. That's good. So you don't have to.
They're
people
walking into our stores. Even our cashiers won't wear masks.
Wow. So in restaurants, the servers aren't wearing masks?
That I don't know because I don't eat out.
Okay, but that's big if they're not doing it in stores, because you may have found a piece of Shangri-La there. That's cling to it. That's great.
Yeah, on that part. On the other hand, crime's on the rise, which I don't care for.
Crime's on the rise, yeah, it's, it's, I don't know what to think about crime at this point because, you know, we live in pretty much a criminal state. So, my thinking is outside the left-right paradigm there where I don't even know what crime means. And if you've got prosecutors all over the country that aren't prosecuting crime, you have in California and states like that where they've legalized shoplifting. So I don't know. I don't know what crime means anymore. So how bad is your crime there?
Well... It's just, it's blatant.
Mm-hmm.
These people are blatant about it. I mean, it's, they're meth. They're on meth.
Mm-hmm.
It's ridiculous. They're running like, I don't know, a Grand Theft Auto ring or something going on out there.
Yeah. Well, it
and
sounds...
they aren't even sneaky about it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, and Chuck is talking about in Georgia, he says it's very racially divided with the masks. I'm wondering what he means by that, because I'm under the impression that blacks are getting vaccinated by far the lowest levels. They're not getting vaccinated, but I'm reading your thing to indicate that as far as masks, that are you saying, Chuck, that more blacks wear them or don't wear them? You're saying there's I'm not sure I understand your. I haven't noticed anything like that around my. Everybody wears them here, except for me. Yes, more blacks wear them here. Wow, that's interesting. Hmm. Well, I don't know what to think of that. But have you noticed any kind of that? Well, you're saying basically nobody wears masks where you are, Jimmy, right?
Yeah, no one.
Well, that's incredible. That's boy. You've said you're in a place where a lot of us would like to be, because it said here, Chris says in Providence, Rhode Island, it's illegal now to rob your neighbor's property. Yeah, that's what I hear too. That some of these DAs are making it so they're taking things like breaking and entering they're not prosecuting that. I don't know what the hell. On the other hand, they want to put you in jail for thought crimes. So it's hard to figure out what's going on. It's very confusing. Now you're in the land of, I guess, Gretchen Whitmer, and I don't know what your representatives are. I'm surprised that there's because we think of Gretchen Whitmer as the biggest woke politician out there almost. But does she know about your area? And she must be irate about it.
Oh, she ignores our area. If you ever look at an election map, what you'll see is that there's like four blue counties in the whole state. They just happen to be the most populous.
Mm-hmm.
Really, Michigan is very much a so-called conservative state outside of a few big cities.
Right. Right. What do you see happening and over the next immediate? You said here we're going to have mandates at least for bars. I don't know. There are rumors of other stuff. I'm told, you enjoy it while you can, walking around these places without a mask, because they're going to force you to. And it's I don't like complying with that stuff. Do you there are not any rumors of any changes where you're at all?
Who's going to implement it? I mean, the police here are in agreement with us. I mean,
wow.
There's no one running around acting nuts about masks.
Mm-hmm. No, that's, if you even got the police on your side, you're doing well, Jimmy. I don't know where you're at, man, but I wouldn't move if I were you. I may move there because that sounds like an idyllic place. Nobody wearing masks. The police are cool. I mean, that's just that alone is pretty amazing.
Well, I didn't say the police were cool.
Okay.
That might be a bit much.
Okay, yeah, so we're taking it too far. But at least they don't care about the masks. Well, that's good. Yeah, I guess I don't know that they're cool anywhere, but that's good. So you're not running? You don't run into any flack from your employer about masks or anything?
No, my employer's 100% all right with it, but that's because I'm gainfully unemployed.
You know what? A lot of the people that talk to me are that way, and I guess I'm not that employed because I'm a full-time writer, so I understand. I don't think I would do well in the working world now. Things have changed a lot since I left there involuntarily 3 years ago, because I don't think I would go well with keeping a mask on, and now they don't want you to talk about controversial things on the job, and that's all I ever did for 44 years.
I would never. There's, most companies, wherever I would end up with, somehow, I don't know, they like to make me the, as they called it, like at one point, well, you're the flow master. What's that mean? Well, you're going to be the mean guy.
Yeah, well, I was always a rabble rouser, and I would be more a rabble rouser than ever now, because, the rabble needs to be roused. We need to get behind. So what else is on your mind?
Well, let's see. We've got all kinds of the government's overtly criminal.
Yeah.
Boy, I don't know. I'll let you back to your thing. I guess I got the, unless you got a question for me. Oh, did you hear any good new news or knowledge from the new JFK files for me?
No, I have not. In fact, I think Peter mentioned that earlier. Not yet. I haven't had a chance to examine them, but I most of the time they make a big deal when they do these releases, and most of the time they may be slightly less redacted, but they're still heavily redacted. So finding anything significant is not easy, and I don't know if I have the patience to wade through all of them, but I'll keep an eye out there. But I doubt it's going to be anything significant, but I'll certainly be looking for it. And, you know, any release is a good release. But, you know, there's no reason to be withholding anything. And there's no reason to have anything redacted. It's ridiculous. But that's what you get when they do release them. A lot of times you really can't even tell what they're talking about because they're redacting names and dates and everything. So what do you, it's really insignificant.
Yeah, it's kind of discouraging.
Now we just have to keep the chin up and try to, you know, try to plug along. That's all we can do, you know, and just hope that eventually there's you know, that they hope that they don't throw us in the, because I'll say to you, like I say to everybody else, I'd love to meet all my cyber friends, but someday, but I don't want it to be in the FEMA camps, and I fear sometimes that's where I'm going to be meeting a lot of you guys in the FEMA camps. So let's hope it doesn't come to that.
Yeah, I hope not.
Absolutely, yeah, that's cool. Well, you, Jimmy, I'd
rather to meet at Zero Watts, Zero Rec. Is that, what is that, next 2023? Wouldn't it be?
Which one? The what? The
Cyril Weck, he only does one every 10 years, right?
Cyril Weck? What, Cyril Weck is...
I hope.
Cyril Weck's a medical...
He does a what do you call it, convention every 10 years.
Oh, does he? I don't know. He was on my show a couple years ago, and he's... he doesn't go to that many conventions. He's 90 years old now, so... I don't think...
I think Jimmy means the ones that he does at Duquesne, Don. That's probably what he means, every 10 years. But but Cyril does participate here and there in different things, not as much as he used to. But is that what you mean, Jimmy? The Duquesne conferences?
Yeah. It'd be 23, wouldn't it be, Chuck? The big one.
Yeah, I haven't checked on it, but if you check with Ben Wecht on social media, his son, you'll definitely be able to find it there. And I'm assuming there'll be one for the 60th anniversary. 60th, but who knows?
Yeah, that would make sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, hopefully I'll see both you guys there someday.
I hope so. Let's just hope it's not in the FEMA camps. Like I said, let's hope we're still running around loose. All right, Jimmy. Well, Jimmy, it's always great to hear from you, man. I appreciate you calling. I appreciate you listening and contributing in the chat room. It's great to have you here.
Hey, great show. Good night. Bye.
Thanks, Jimmy. Thanks for calling. Let's see. I missed the chat room. How's Chris?
You know, real quick note on Jimmy James there, Don, is, you know, he won books on the book giveaway night on Uccelli.com, right? And problem, he would have wanted some of yours, but he already had them. So, okay. So that's a guy who reads, listens, everything. Okay, just saying.
Oh, thank Jimmy. I can't tell you. I'm sure you're still listening. That's wonderful. That's what keeps me going, knowing that there are people out there like that. It's very cool. I really appreciate it. Chris says, how's the book doing? Any updates on the Aftermath FM situation with iPro Testament? Well, last week was Christmas Eve, last Friday, and this Friday's going to be New Year's Eve. So I'm not going to... one of the guys there who I've been going back to, he claims he's going to be sitting by next time, so we won't have the same issues. So we'll see. So next Friday, we should be on the air at the same time, same bat channel. America Unplugged is still every Saturday at 12 noon, typically, with Billy Ray and Tony Arterburn. And I'm going to be on Tim Kelly tonight, for those of you who are fans of him. I'm going to be at, you know, just an hour after the show is over at 9 p.m. I haven't been back on there for a while. Him and Tim's are interesting times. He has a nice fan base. A lot of people discovered me on there, so it'd be nice to talk to Tim again. I've talked to him for a while. I think he was sick for a while. He's back to full strength, so that's pretty cool. He says, I missed the multiple Donald shots per week. Well, you know, you still, I'm still out there quite a bit. I appreciate that. And of course, I'm on rents every Monday as well. And hopefully we'll get the Don and Ella show back. If Ella, you know, once Ella ever gets back to full strength, I like doing that show with her too. But right now that's on hiatus. I have a shirt that says, from out of the night there came a scream. Who put the sand in the Vaseline? Bronson Mitchell. FEMA camps are not for the timid. Yeah, I wouldn't think so. Like, I mean, I don't want to be in any of these kind of things because, you know, I There's a reason why I don't go camping. I'm basically a big pussy with that stuff. You know, I can't go without my internet very long. No electricity, nah, forget about it. I would not do well in those situations. I guess I'd have to adapt, but still, maybe I'd be bitching and complaining so much they'd let me go. I don't know. But Chris says, Don and Chuck's JFK presentation, is it still available? And Chuck says email. Okay, cool. Yeah, should be out there. So go to Chuck for that. Okay, so that's it. So, yeah, a lot of stuff. You know, we have the Ghislaine Maxwell and the JFK releases, which, again, I don't know what's there. I'll be looking to see what they talk about. I saw Rex Bradford already had a release on it, but he didn't really go into what was there. I don't know if he's looked at it or not. You know, it's – I know from, you know, trying to do Hidden History 3, and thanks again to the great help from Chris Graves and Peter C. Koch and Bob Wilson, especially – they lead me to these things, but even so, you know, going through the House Select Committee testimony that's available, most of it isn't available. Larry Hancock's blog, I'll have to check him out too. Most of it's not available. I don't know where it's at. You know, you'll hear so many people talk to the HSCA. Well, where's their testimony? Or you can't find it. So the Orleans Parish testimony, going through, you know, things like that, there you can find gems, and I have found some interesting things. But it's tedious work going through the Mary Farrell database. There's lots of stuff there. But you really got to search. It's like looking for a needle in a haystack to try to find some. There is significant stuff. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see. But, you know, I don't hold out a lot of hope because, I don't think they have anything listed there that documents what they were going to do. Chris says, will it be repeated the January 6th shenanigans? I don't know, man. That's a date to watch. Needless to say, you know, I, of course, I'm in Northern Virginia, so I am pretty close to D.C. I wouldn't be anywhere near D.C. on that. So I have no idea what they're planning to do about anything. But I know that whatever it is, it will be no good. And that's what, you know, so many people have turned to being anarchists, let alone libertarians. It's because we're just when our so-called leaders, our elected leader, selected leaders get together and do anything, the odds are so overwhelmingly that it's going to be something that makes things worse, that it's not even funny. They almost never do anything to improve things. I don't know when the last time was that they did something to improve things. I really don't know. I guess the Civil Rights Law, the original Civil Rights Act, maybe. I don't know. In my lifetime, there's the Freedom of Information Act. That was a nice act. It was back when I was, you know, a staunch liberal Democrat. I thought the Democrats were the good guys. Young guy, early 20s, teens, early 20s. And Freedom of Information Act was, boy, that was sacred to me. But, you know, you see how it's been twisted and it's produced some good things, but again, even then, it's kicking and screaming. You know, you gotta do everything you can. Harold Weisberg trudged into D.C. every day of his life for the last 20 years, even though he's a sick man at advanced age, just to try to sue these suckers for, you know, an FBI document here or there. Chris says, I can't find a testimony of Dorothy Kilgallen's father report UHS. Yes, exactly. And I know we've talked about that. And that's, you know, Dorothy Kilgallen's father was alive still at the time of the HSC investigation, and he had information. He wanted to talk to that. He had suspicions. And I would love to see those records. You can't find them anywhere. Believe me, if Chris can't find them, nobody can. That's unbelievable. And I've tried to get a hold of, Dorothy's son, and I left a message for him and he didn't call me back. And that's what I'm finding, you know, is that I find so many of these phone numbers and that, you know, again, I get from people like Chris and Bob Wilson and Peter. I think they were the real contact info, or you just look them up yourself on 411.com. 95% maybe, of the numbers that you call these people that are related to these events in any way, shape, or form, the numbers are disconnected. Now, you know, I think that's beyond any law of averages. And the ones you do get through, And I can't, you know, I don't answer the phone for strangers either. So I don't really expect people to answer the phone anymore these days with caller ID and everything. But they don't answer the phone. And so you leave a message, a voicemail message. And again, I know they're not going to call me. And they don't. So I don't think one person that I've called and left a message for has ever called me back. So it's difficult getting through to these people. And you email most of them. Most of the ones that you email don't get back to you. So there's a clear reluctance on people that are associated with the JFK assassination, the JFK Jr., 9/11, Oklahoma City, any of these things. I mean, I don't even attempt anybody associated with Sandy Hook. Any of these things, anybody associated with these things, they clearly don't want to talk. And I think that's very curious, as I've said. You know, if there are no conspiracies and these are all unrelated events, nothing to see, move along here, you know, the mantra from the online trolls. If that's the case, then why would anybody be scared of anything? Why would they be reluctant to talk about it? But they are. They clearly are. And there's a sense that you have to be careful even talking to them at all, that, you know, they might sue you, especially when you get in the Sandy Hook area, just for simply talking about it and asking questions. And it should never be wrong to ask questions. Yes, Chris, I did get the Dick Gregory article about John Belushi and Freddie Prinze contacting him in Lane. Yep. And that verified. I wish I had known before On Borrowed Fame was published that, so I didn't get to include the Dick Gregory. I don't know how I missed that Dick Gregory tidbit. Yeah, so Belushi verified. Yes, it was written by Gregory himself. Basically verified what I had always assumed, that Belushi was, like Freddie Prinze, obsessed with the JFK assassination. So there you have Belushi. You have Freddie Prinze, you have Sal Mineo, all three of them known to be very interested in these subjects, all dying unnaturally. And those are the ones that just that we know. You know, we don't know, you know, how many others there might be. Like I said, if I hadn't been in Mark Lane's office that day as a teenager, I would have had no reason to connect Freddie Prinze to the JFK assassination, certainly not based on anything I saw in the mainstream media. The Last Days of Freddie Prinze movie, TV movie, didn't mention the JFK assassination, when I know for a fact that that was his main preoccupation. He was totally obsessed with it. So if they had been trying to portray those last days honestly, they would have shown him maybe doing drugs, but they would have shown him watching the Zapruder film over and over again, calling Mark Lane, which is what the, and so, you know, that was when I was a teenager. It's one of the first things I realized, wow, very disillusioning that, that here you have them lying. And that's the kind of thing that started driving me further down the rabbit hole, because I realized, wow, there's this goes way beyond any kind of, you know, a mirror thing. It's yes, he was supposed to be in Detroit. That's right, Chris. And it was really interesting to see that. And I said, I had suspected that, but again, who knows? I mean, I don't know. You know, I know Phil Hartman. You know, that's when I first got interested in Dave McGowan. I just found the story of Phil Hartman's death very suspicious. I did a search for it online. It led me to Dave McGowan, who was suspicious of it as well. So who knows how many other people there are, you know, that are like that. And Chuck has left the the link to On Borrowed Fame, Money, Mysteries, and Corruption in the Entertainment World, my new book, forward by John Barber. I hope all of you will check it out. It's doing okay out there. And, you know, I'm doing some interviews about it, but maybe any of you are out there, try contacting Access Hollywood or Extra, shows like that. My wife, you know, watches it. Oh, they'll love your book. Honey, you got to get them to answer you first. So maybe if they hear from people that are saying, hey, you guys should cover this book, maybe they will, because I would think they're hungry for stories and they should like this, you know, theoretically. Anyhow, I hear the music coming up, so... Thanks, everybody, for listening to I Protest Again. Keep sending forth those tiny ripples of hope. See you next week. Same bat time, same bat channel. Thanks for listening.